Chapter 5. Clarity, Discipline, and Consistency. Nature abhors a vacuum. In order to promote life, Mother Nature attempts to find balance whenever possible. When life is destroyed because of a forest fire, for example, nature will introduce new life to replace it. The existence of a food chain in any ecosystem in which each animal exists as food for another is a way of maintaining balance. The golden circle, grounded in the natural principles of biology, obeys the need for balance as well. As I've discussed, when the why is absent, imbalance is produced and manipulations thrive. When manipulations thrive, uncertainty increases for buyers, instability increases for sellers, and stress increases for all. Symptoms of imbalance are common. Things like increase of stress or decrease of passion. Obsession with what your competition is doing over what you are doing. Starting with why is just the beginning. There is still work to be done before a person or an organization earns the right or the ability to inspire. For the golden circle to work, each of the pieces must be in balance and in the right order. Clarity of why. It all starts with clarity. You have to know why you do what you do. If people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. So it follows that if you don't know why you do what you do, how will anyone else? If the leader of an organization can't clearly articulate why the organization exists in terms beyond its products or services, then how does he expect the employees to know why to come to work? If a politician can't articulate why she seeks public office beyond the standard, quote-unquote, to serve people, the minimum rational standard for all politicians, then how will the voters know whom to follow? Manipulations can motivate the outcome of an election, but they don't help choose who should lead. To lead requires those who are willing to follow. It requires those who believe in something bigger than a single issue. To inspire starts with clarity of why. Discipline of how. Once you know why you do what you do, the question is how will you do it? Hows are your values or principles that guide how to bring your cause to life. How we do things manifests in the systems and the processes within an organization and the culture. Understanding how you do things, and more importantly, having the discipline to hold the organization and its employees accountable to those guiding principles, enhances an organization's ability to work to its natural strengths. Understanding how gives greater ability to hire people or find partners, for example, who will naturally thrive when working with you. Ironically, the most important question with the most elusive answer, why you do what you do, is actually quite simple and efficient to discover, and I'll share that in later chapters. It's the discipline to never veer from your cause, to hold yourself accountable to how you do things, that's the hardest part. Making it even more complicated for ourselves, we try to remind ourselves of our values by writing them on the wall as nouns: integrity, honesty, innovation, communication, for example. But nouns are not actionable. They're things. You can't build systems or develop incentives around those things. It's nearly impossible to hold people accountable to nouns. A little more innovation today, if you would please, Bob. And if you have to write honesty on the wall to remind you to do it, then I think you have bigger problems anyway. For values or guiding principles to be truly effective, they have to be verbs. They're actions. It's not integrity. It's always do the right thing. It's not innovation. It's look at the problem from a different angle. Articulating our values as verbs gives us a clear idea of how to act in any situation. We can hold each other accountable to them, measure them, or even build incentives around them. Simply telling people to have integrity doesn't guarantee that their decisions will always keep the customer's or client's best interests in mind. Telling them to always do the right thing does. I wonder what values Samsung had written on the wall when they developed that rebate that wasn't applicable to people living in apartment buildings. The golden circle offers an explanation for long-term success. But the inherent nature of doing things for the long term often includes investments or short-term costs. This is the reason the discipline to stay focused on the why and remain true to your values matters so much. Consistency of what? Everything you say and everything you do has to prove what you believe. A why is just a belief. That's all it is. Hows are the actions we take to realize that belief, and whats are the results of those actions, everything you say and everything you do, your products, services, marketing, PR, culture, and who you hire. If people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it, then all these things must be consistent. With consistency, we will see and hear, without a shadow of a doubt, what you believe. After all, we live in a tangible world. The only way people will know what you believe is by the things you say and the things you do. And if you're not consistent in the things you say and do, no one will know what you believe. It is at the what level that authenticity happens. Authenticity. It's that word so often bandied about in corporate and political worlds. Everyone talks about the importance of being authentic. You must be authentic, experts say. All the trend data shows that people prefer to do business with the authentic brands. People vote for the authentic candidate. Problem is, that instruction is totally unactionable. How do you go into someone's office and say, from now on, please, a little more authenticity in all that you do? That marketing piece that you're working on, a CEO might instruct, make it a little more authentic if you would, please. What do companies do to make their marketing or their sales or whatever they're doing more authentic? The common solution is hilarious to me. They go out and do customer research and ask the customers, what would we have to tell you for us to be authentic? This entirely misses the point. You can't ask others what you have to do to be authentic. Being authentic means that you already know. What is a politician supposed to say when told to be more authentic? How does a leader act more authentically? Without a clear understanding of why, the instruction is completely useless. What authenticity means is that your golden circle is in balance. It means that everything you say and everything you do, you actually believe. This goes for management as well as the employees. Only when that happens can the things you say and do be viewed as authentic. Apple believed that its original Apple computer and its Macintosh challenged the dominant IBM DOS platform. Apple believes its iPod and iTunes products are challenging the status quo in the music industry. And we all understand why Apple does what it does. It is because of that mutual understanding that we view those Apple products as authentic. Dell introduced MP3 players and PDAs in an attempt to enter the small electronics business. We don't know what Dell's why is anymore. We have no certainty about what the company believes or why it produced those products beyond self-gain or a desire to capitalize on new market segments. Those products are not authentic. It's not that Dell couldn't enter other markets. It certainly has the knowledge and ability to make good products, but its ability to do so without a clear understanding of why is what makes it much harder and much more expensive. Just producing high-quality products and marketing them does not guarantee success. Authenticity cannot be achieved without clarity of why, and authenticity matters. Ask the best salesman what it takes to be a great salesman. They will always tell you that it helps when you really believe in the product you're selling. What does belief have to do with sales? Simple. When salesmen actually believe in the thing they are selling, then the words that come out of their mouth are authentic. When belief enters the equation, passion exudes from the salesman. It is the authenticity that produces the relationships upon which all the best sales organizations are based. Relationships also build trust, and with trust comes loyalty. Absent a balanced golden circle means no authenticity, which means no strong relationships, which means no trust. And you're back to square one, selling on price, service, quality, and features. You're back to being like everyone else. Worse, without that authenticity, companies will resort to manipulations. Pricing, promotions, fear, peer pressure, take your pick. Effective? Of course. But only for the short term. Being authentic is not a requirement for success. It is if you want success to be lasting, however. Again, it goes back to why. Authenticity is when you say and do the things you actually believe. But if you don't know why the organization or the products exist on a level beyond what you do, then it is impossible to know if the things you say or do are consistent with your why. Without why, any attempt at authenticity will almost always be inauthentic. The right order. After you have clarity of why, are disciplined and accountable to your own values and guiding principles, and are consistent in all you say and do, the final step is to keep it all in the right order. Just like that little Apple marketing example I used earlier, simply changing the order of the information, starting with why, changed the impact of the message. The what's are important. They provide the tangible proof of the why. But the why must come first. The why provides the context for everything else. As you will hear over and over in all the cases I use, whether in leadership, decision-making, or communication, starting with why has a profound and long-lasting impact on the result. Starting with why is what inspires people to act. If you don't know why, you can't know how. Rollin King, a San Antonio businessman, hatched the idea to take what Pacific Southwest was doing in California and bring it to Texas, to start an airline that flew short-haul flights between Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio. He had recently gone through a long and messy divorce and turned to the one man he trusted to help him get his idea off the ground, his wild turkey-drinking, chain-smoking divorce lawyer, Herb Kelleher. In nearly every way, King and Kelleher were opposites. King, a numbers guy, was notoriously gruff and awkward, while Kelleher was gregarious and likable. At first, Kelleher called King's idea a dumb one, but by the end of the evening, King had successfully inspired him with his vision, and Kelleher agreed to consider coming on board. It would take 4 years, however, before Southwest Airlines would make its first flight from Dallas's Love Field to Houston. Southwest did not invent the concept of a low-cost airline. Pacific Southwest Airlines pioneered the industry. Southwest even copied their name. Southwest had no first-mover's advantage. Braniff International Airways, Texas International Airlines, and Continental Airlines were already serving the Texas market. And none was eager to give up any ground. But Southwest was not built to be an airline. It was built to champion a cause. They just happened to use an airline to do it. In the early 1970s, only 15% of the traveling population traveled by air. At that rate, the market was small enough to scare off most would-be competitors to the big airlines. But Southwest wasn't interested in competing against everyone else for 15% of the traveling population. Southwest cared about the other 85%. Back then, if you had asked Southwest whom their competition was, they would have told you, "We compete against the car and the bus." But what they meant was, "We're the champion for the common man." That was why they started the airline. That was their cause, their purpose, their reason for existing. How they went about building their company was not a strategy developed by a high-priced management consultancy. It wasn't a collection of best practices that they saw other companies doing. Their guiding principles and values stemmed directly from their why and were more common sense than anything else. In the 1970s, air travel was expensive. And if Southwest was going to be the champion for the common man, they had to be cheap. It was an imperative. It was how they were going to bring their why to life. And in a day and age when air travel was elitist, back then people wore ties on planes. As the champion for the common man, Southwest had to be fun. That's how they had to do it. It was an imperative. And in a time where air travel was complicated, with different prices depending on when you booked, Southwest had to be simple. If they were to be accessible to the other 85% of the population, then simplicity was an imperative. At the time, Southwest had two price categories: nights and weekends, and daytime. That was it. Simple. Cheap, fun, and simple. That's how they did it. That's how they were to champion the cause of the common man. The result of their actions was made tangible in the things they said and the things they did. Their product, the people they hired, their culture, and their marketing. "You're now free to move about the country," they said in their advertising. That's much more than a tagline. It's a cause, and it's a cause looking for followers. Those who could relate to Southwest, those who saw themselves as average Joes, now had an alternative to the big airlines. They also had an alternative to the car or the bus. And those who believed what Southwest believed became fiercely loyal to the company. They felt Southwest was a company that spoke directly to them and directly for them. More importantly, they felt that flying Southwest said something about who they were as people. The loyalty that developed with their customers had nothing to do with price. Price was simply one of the ways the airline brought their cause to life. Howard Putnam, one of the former presidents of Southwest, likes to tell a story of a senior executive of a large company who approached him after an event. The executive said that he always flew one of the big airlines when he traveled on business. He had to. It was a company mandate. And although he had accumulated many frequent flyer miles on the other airline, and money was no object, when he flew for himself or with his family, he always chose Southwest. "He loves Southwest," Putnam says with a grin when he tells the story. Just because Southwest is cheap doesn't mean it only appeals to those with less money. Cheap is just one of the things Southwest does that helps us understand what they believe. What Southwest has achieved is the stuff of business folklore. As a result of why they do what they do, and because they are highly disciplined in how they do it, they are the most profitable airline in history. There's never been a year that they didn't turn a profit, including after September 11th and during the oil crises of the 1970s and early 2000s. Everything Southwest says and does is authentic. Everything about them reflects the original cause King and Kelleher set out to champion decades earlier. It has never veered. Fast forward about 30 years. United Airlines and Delta Airlines looked at the success of Southwest and decided they needed a low-cost product to compete and share in Southwest's success. We gotta get us one of those, they thought. In April 2003, Delta launched their low-cost alternative, Song. Less than a year later, United launched TED. In both cases, they copied how Southwest did it. They made TED and Song cheap, fun, and simple. Just like Southwest. And for anyone who ever flew TED or Song, they were cheap, they were fun, and they were simple. And they both failed. United and Delta were both old hands in the airline business, and every bit qualified to add whatever products they felt necessary to adapt to market conditions or seize opportunities. The problem was not what they did. The problem was, no one knew why Song or TED existed. They may have even been better than Southwest. But it didn't matter. Sure, people flew them, but there were always reasons why people will do business with you that have nothing to do with you. That people can be motivated to use your product is not the issue. The problem was that too few were loyal to the brands. Without a clear sense of why, Song and TED were just another couple of airlines. Without a clear sense of why, all that people had to judge them on was price or convenience. They were commodities that had to rely on manipulations to build their businesses, an expensive proposition to say the least. United abandoned TED just 4 years after it began, and Delta Song also took its last flight only 4 years after it launched. It is a false assumption that differentiation happens in how and what you do. Simply offering a high-quality product with more features or better service or a better price does not create difference. Doing so guarantees no success. Differentiation happens in why and how you do it. Southwest isn't the best airline in the world, nor are they always the cheapest. They have fewer routes than many of their competition and don't even fly outside the continental United States. What they do is not always significantly better. But why they do it is crystal clear, and everything they do proves it. There are many ways to motivate people to do things, but loyalty comes from the ability to inspire people to do things. Only when the why is clear and people believe what you believe can a true, loyal relationship develop. Manipulation and inspiration are similar, but not the same. Manipulation and inspiration both tickle the limbic brain. Aspirational messages, fear, or peer pressure all push us to decide one way or another by appealing to our irrational desires or playing on our fears. But it's when that emotional feeling goes deeper than insecurity or uncertainty or dreams that the emotional reaction aligns with how we view ourselves. It is at that point that behavior moves from being motivated to inspired. When we are inspired, the decisions we make have more to do with who we are and less to do with the companies or the products we're buying. When our decisions feel right, we're willing to pay a premium or suffer an inconvenience for those products or services. This has nothing to do with price or quality. Price, quality, features, and service are important, but they are the cost of entry in business today. It is those visceral limbic feelings that create loyalty. And it is that loyalty that gives Apple, or Harley Davidson, or Southwest Airlines, or Martin Luther King, or any other great leader who commands a following such a huge advantage. Without a strong base of loyal followers, the pressure increases to manipulate, to compete, or differentiate based on price, quality, service, or features. Loyalty, the feeling of real emotional value, exists in the brain of the buyer, not the seller. It's hard to make a case to someone that your products or services are important in their lives based on external rational factors that you defined as valuable. Remember the Ferrari versus the Honda? However, if your why and their why are aligned, then they will see your products and services as tangible ways to prove what they believe. When why and how and what are in balance, authenticity is achieved, and the buyer feels fulfilled. When they are out of balance, stress or uncertainty exists. When that happens, the decisions we make will also be out of balance. Without why, the buyer is easily motivated by aspiration or fear. At that point, it is the buyer who is at the greatest risk of ending up being inauthentic. If they buy something that doesn't clearly embody their own sense of why, then those around them have little evidence to paint a clear and accurate picture of who they are. The human animal is a social animal. We are very good at sensing subtleties in behavior and judging people accordingly. We get good feelings and bad feelings about companies just as we get good feelings and bad feelings about people. There are some people we just feel we can trust, and others we just feel we can't. Those feelings also manifest when organizations try to court us. Our ability to feel one way or another toward a person or an organization is the same. What changes is who is talking to us. But it is always a single individual who is listening. Even a company that airs its message on TV, for example, no matter how many people see that commercial, it's always and only an individual that can receive the message. This is the core value of the Golden Circle. It provides a way to communicate consistent with how individuals receive information. For this reason, an organization must be clear about its purpose, its cause, or belief, and make sure that everything they say and everything they do is consistent and authentic to that belief. If the levels of the Golden Circle are in balance, all those who share the organization's view of the world will be drawn to it and its products, like a moth to a light bulb. Doing business is like dating. I'd like to introduce you to our imaginary friend, Brad. Brad is going on a date tonight. It's a first date, and he's pretty excited. He thinks the woman he's about to meet is really beautiful, and that she makes a great prospect. Brad sits down for dinner, and he starts talking. "I am extremely rich," he says. "I have a big house, and I drive a beautiful car. I know lots of famous people. I'm on TV all the time, which is good because I'm good-looking. And I've actually done pretty well for myself." The question is, based on the things that Brad says, does Brad get a second date? The way we communicate and the way we behave is all a matter of biology. That means we can make some comparisons between the things we do in our social lives and the things we do in our professional lives. After all, people are people. To learn how to apply the why to a business situation, you needn't look much farther than how we act on a date. Because in reality, there is no difference between sales and dating. In both circumstances, you sit across the table from your prospect and hope to say enough of the right things to close the deal. Of course, you could always opt for a manipulation or two, a fancy dinner, dropping hints of tickets that you may have or whom you know. Depending on how badly you want to close the deal, you could tell them anything they want to hear, promise them the world, and the odds are good that you'll close the deal. Once, maybe twice. With time, however, maintaining that relationship will cost more and more. No matter the manipulations you choose, this is not the way to build a trusting relationship. In Brad's case, it is obvious that the date did not go well. The odds are not good that he will get a second date, and he's certainly not done a good job of laying down the foundation to build a relationship. Ironically, the woman's initial interest may have been generated based on those elements. She agreed to go on the date in the first place because her friends told her that Brad was good-looking and he had a good job and he knew lots of famous people. Even all those things may be true, whats don't drive decision-making. Whats should be used as proof of why, and the date plainly fell flat. Let's send Brad out on that date again, and this time he's going to start with why. "You know what I love about my life," he starts this time. "I get to wake up every day to do something I love. I get to inspire people to do the things that inspire them. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. In fact, the best part is trying to figure out all the different ways I can do it. It's really amazing. And believe it or not, I've actually been able to make a lot of money from it. I bought a big house and a nice car. I get to meet a lot of famous people, and I get to be on TV all the time, which is fun because I'm good looking. And I'm very lucky that I'm doing something that I love. I've actually been able to do pretty well because of it." This time, the chances Brad will get a second date, assuming that whoever is sitting across from him believes what he believes, went up exponentially. More importantly, he's also laying a good foundation for a relationship, one based on values and beliefs. He said all the same things on the first date. The only difference is he started with why, and all the what's, all the tangible benefits, all served as proof of that why. Now consider how most companies do business. Someone sits down across a table from you. They've heard you're a good prospect, and they start talking. "Our company is extremely successful," they say. "We have beautiful offices. You should stop by and check them out sometime. We do business with all the biggest companies and brands. I'm sure you've seen our advertising. We're actually doing pretty well." In business, like a bad date, many companies work so hard to prove their value without saying why they exist in the first place. You'll have to do more than show your resume before someone finds you appealing, however. But that is exactly what companies do. They provide you with a long list of their experience, what they've done, who they know, all with the idea that you will find them so desirable that you will have to drop everything to do business with them. People are people, and the biology of decision-making is the same no matter where it is, whether it's a personal decision or a business decision. It's obvious that in the dating scenario, it was a bad date. So why would we expect it to be any different in the business scenario? Like on a date, it is exceedingly difficult to start building a trusted relationship with a potential customer or client by trying to convince them of all the rational features and benefits. Those things are important, but they only serve to give credibility to a sales pitch and allow buyers to rationalize their purchase decision later on. As with all decisions, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it, and what you do serves as the tangible proof of why you do it. But unless you start with why, all people have to go on are the rational benefits, and chances are you won't get a second date. Here's the alternative. You know what I love about our company? Every single one of us comes to work every day to do something we love. We get to inspire people to do the things that inspire them. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. In fact, the fun part is trying to figure out all the different ways, all the different products and services we can come up with to do that. It really is amazing. The best part is, it's also good for business. We're doing really well. We have beautiful offices. You should stop by sometime to see. We work with some of the biggest companies. I'm sure you've seen our ads. We're actually doing pretty well. Now, how certain are you that the second pitch was better than the first? 3 degrees of certainty. When we can only provide a rational basis for a decision, when we can only point to tangible elements or rational measurements, the highest level of confidence we can give is, "I think this is the right decision." That would be biologically accurate, because we're activating the neocortex, the thinking part of our brain. At a neocortical level, we can verbalize our thoughts. This is what's happening when we spend all that time sifting through the pros and cons, listing all the differences between plasma or LCD, Dell versus HP. When we make gut decisions, the highest level of confidence we can offer is the decision feels right, even if it flies in the face of all the facts and figures. Again, this is biologically accurate, because gut decisions happen in the part of the brain that controls our emotions, but not language. Ask the most successful entrepreneurs and leaders what their secret is, and invariably, they all say the same thing. "I trust my gut." The times things went wrong, they'll tell you, "I listened to what others were telling me, even though it didn't feel right to me. I should have trusted my gut." It's a good strategy, except it's not scalable. The gut decision can only be made by a single person. It's a perfectly good strategy for an individual or a small organization. But what happens when success necessitates that more people be able to make decisions that feel right? That's when the power of why can be fully realized. The ability to put a why into words provides the emotional context for decisions. It offers greater confidence than "I think it's the right decision." It's more scalable than "I feel it's the right decision." When you know your why, the highest level of confidence you can offer is "I know it's the right decision." When you know the decision is right, not only does it feel right, but you can also rationalize it and easily put it into words. The decision is fully balanced. The rational what's offer proof of the feeling of why. If you can verbalize the feeling that drove the gut decision, if you can clearly state your why, you'll provide a clear context for all those around you to understand why that decision was made. If the decision is consistent with the facts and figures, then those facts and figures serve to reinforce the decision. This is balance. And if the decision flies in the face of all the facts and figures, if your gut doesn't match the rationalization, then it will highlight that other factors need to be considered before the decision can be made. It can turn a controversial decision from a debate into a discussion. My former business partner, for example, would get upset when I turned away business. I would tell him that a potential client didn't feel right. It would frustrate him to no end, because the client's money was as good as anyone else's, he would tell me. He couldn't understand the reason for my decision, and worse, I couldn't explain it. It was just a feeling I had. In contrast, these days, I can easily explain why I'm in business, to inspire people to do the things that inspire them. If I were to make the same decision now for the same gut reason, there is no debate because everyone is clear why the decision was made. We turn away business because those potential clients don't believe what we believe, and they are not interested in anything to do with inspiring people. With a clear sense of why, the debate to take on a bad fit client turns into a discussion of whether the imbalance is worth the short-term gain that they might provide us. The goal of business should not be to do business with everyone who needs what you have. The goal is to focus on people who believe what you believe. When we are selective about doing business only with those who believe in our why, trust emerges.